I believe it.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is September 15, 2009. We are spinning ever closer to the next equinox, and with each passing day, that 2012 deadline is looming ever closer. Each day, I'm another day older and a hair slower. It's forcing me to rethink and sometimes maybe even begin to think about things that I had never considered important or relevant before as my load of allotted days gets ever smaller. As I explore ideas in spaces that have no form, I learn new things and create new questions with that exploration. Answers seem to be ever scarcer as I grow older, like some exotic species that is in the twilight of its existence within this realm. In the process, I've had some of the most peculiar dreams. And as the dreams get ever weirder, I find that it's much easier to read the messages woven into their fabric. Messages that when I was much younger, I would have missed and needed help to even see. Are these messages one of my subconscious? Are they messages from some higher power? Perhaps they are a demonic delivery. I've had all three of these explanations given to me, sometimes with more force than the word give really implies. Some of them, I would say, are definitely my subconscious, making sure that I have a sense of awareness of something that I should be paying attention to. Sometimes I think it's surely a message originating with a higher power, but never have I had a dream that I would interpret as demonic in any way. I solve problems in my sleep. I work out solutions, or at least best-case scenarios, as I slumber. Some situations have no real resolution, and best case may not even be all that great, but it's still the best of the potential options. But what is sleep? Sleep is an altered state of consciousness. What do hallucinogenic drugs do? Alter your state of consciousness. So before anybody jumps up and points a finger and screams that we are suggesting that anyone start playing with recreational drugs, let's get that right in the bud. The use of the substances is potentially dangerous. No one should go around brewing up anything of the like without having a mentor, without knowing exactly what their goals are and how they're going to go about doing this. Not everyone should even try this method of altering their state of consciousness for a long list of reasons. And to waste the experience merely in search of a thrill is really a sin in the deepest sense of the word. Once upon a time, I was highly skeptical of the choice to use any of the potential plants or animals to achieve an altered state of consciousness, and probably was nearly rude in my state of skepticism about their value. Like many other things over the years, I have been made to eat my words. My opinion has now been revised to include such rituals as actual religious experiences that definitely benefit those that participate in them. For those that can barely contain their curiosity, no, I have not participated in these rituals, nor have I personally used these brews. I'm basing my changed opinion on secondhand research, which is probably much better than basing it on fundamentalist-inspired narrow-mindedness regarding other practices. So now I'm going to climb down off of my soapbox, and I would like everyone to welcome James Orr, the author of Tryptamine Palace, and our guest this evening to the Dawn of Shades. James, can you hear me?
Yeah, that was a heck of an intro.
Well, you know, hey, you gotta do the best you can do, right?
No doubt. I go with Tom Waits. There's no devil, there's just God when he's drunk.
Say what again?
I agree with Tom Waits when he says, there is no devil, there's just God when he's drunk.
Ah, okay, okay.
Speaking of demonic dreams and all.
Well, you know, that demonic dream thing, I can't really even say I've even had anybody else tell me about a dream that I would say was demonic in nature.
Yeah,
I can't think of any. Yeah, I think sometimes people use that demonic label when it's something they don't want to hear.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds reasonable. I mean, it seems like it is all contained within the depths of the human consciousness, whatever we call angelic or demonic.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to have balance in everything. You can't have light without dark, right?
Yeah, Huxley's Heaven and Hell. Well, listening to your introduction, I would have to say that I was actually guilty of initially using the sacrament that I write of in my book, 5-MeO-DMT, for recreational use. At the time I first tried it, I was a hardcore atheist, and I certainly didn't think I was going to find any kind of spirituality from ingesting this unknown compound, which was actually quasi-legal at the time and is about to be Schedule 1 by the DEA in this country, which will unfortunately make it illegal. But at the time that I was able to try it, it was readily available on the internet, which made it kind of unusual.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and 5-MeO-DMT is recognized as being one of the most powerful entheogens, which is a compound that can actually produce a heightened sense of spirituality or awareness of God. And I expected it to be not unlike, you know, other things I had tried, like magic mushrooms and different things around the world. But it was completely different, since it took me to a totally transcendental zone, beyond thought, imagery, even language. And when I returned from that experience, which was about 40 minutes in length, the only way I could really describe it was that I had come in contact or had a realization of the nature of God, even though previous to that I had no belief in God whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And that's basically what my book is about, is my initial experience on 5-MeO-DMT and then my search through much of the mystical tradition as well as things like quantum physics to try and put together a worldview that made more sense to me.
Uh-huh. And did you achieve your goal of finding a worldview that makes more sense?
Yeah, I think I've created a synthesis in my book that has definitely helped me to fit back into society, if you like. And I actually get probably an email every couple of weeks from somebody who says they've been given a copy of my book and it's helping them reintegrate their experiences with things like ayahuasca or DMT. There's quite a lot of young people going outside of the country these days, or even inside the country, doing things like ayahuasca, and they're having some very powerful experiences, and they don't have a lot of information to ground their experiences on. So I'm hoping that my book fills in some of that gap.
Yeah, you know, I've interviewed other people who've talked about the ayahuasca experience and whatnot, and, you know, it does seem to be very, very profound. And then, you know, I've also talked to people who have either participated in or been present with those type of things going on, and they've talked about it. And that's really why I said, you know, it does have more validity than I gave it initially. You know, I wasn't a hardcore atheist by any means, but I really did try to maintain a separateness of spirituality and the entire paranormal world. I mean, whatever you wanted to call it. You know, I just walled in the spirituality, and that was off with religion, and I wouldn't let it, you know, associate with anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
It was segregated.
I mean, we've become allergic to the word God in our modern society because so much wrong has been done in its name.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the intellectual position is that God's a form of superstition. But thanks to the use of entheogens, I have had more of a mystical realization of what I think the nature of God is, and it's been so powerful it's totally turned my views around. But in terms of you know, supportive evidence and research, there was a famous experiment done in Harvard in the late 60s by a guy called Walter Punky. and it was an experiment where he gave 30 divinity students at the Harvard Chapel either a placebo or psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. And 65% of those students reported to have a direct contact with the divine during that sermon.
Uh-huh.
30 years later, they followed up, and something like 85% of the people, many of them have gone on to become priests, still rank it as the most significant spiritual experience of their life. And just recently in John Hopkins University, and the researcher Roland Griffins, I think is quite famous due to his research into coffee and tobacco, he decided to sort of recreate the experiment with even more controls. And his result was pretty much the same. 65% of the participants said they had a significant spiritual experience while using psilocybin. So I think there's plenty of statistical proof could be generated about the validity of entheogen use if only the government here in the United States and other countries would actually allow it. The Santo Daime religion, which is out of Brazil, has recently won the right at the Supreme Court to use its tea, which is called huasca, which is a form of ayahuasca, in its ceremonies here in the United States. So the Supreme Court has actually seen that there is a valid use for these substances, or these compounds.
Well, the Native American Church is allowed to use peyote, which
It's interesting that the Peyote Church recently took the name church out of their name because they thought it was turning people away.
Well, you kind of created this kind of confusing imagery. You know, Native American and church just didn't quite mesh together. You know.
Yeah, I hear that.
You know, when you think of church, you think of, you know, the little brown church in the Vale. You think of the little New England chapel. You think of great cathedrals. But you never think of Native Americans.
No.
Just, you know, the images didn't go together. And so, yeah, I could see why they would want to take it out.
You know, they did win that right, but, you know, historically they certainly didn't win that right, the actual use of... Well, peyote actually came to the Indians pretty late. It was actually, they started using it after the white settlers arrived in North America, I believe. But there are many entheogens all around the world that native groups have used for more than 3,000
years.
Well,
from what I've understood, just about every native shamanistic sect had some sort of conscious altering substance they used.
Human beings have been amazingly intuitive in discovering these trees and plants and animals all over the world. For some reason, there's a lot more of them here in the New World than there is in the Old World, which I always find interesting. But in Greece, they had the Eleusinian Mysteries, which ran for over 2,000 years and was considered the high point of Greek culture. And this was a ceremony for the goddess Demeter, and it involved a parade to this town and a pageantry, but the participants were given a brew called Kikion, which we now believe was an ergotized barley, which was basically an LSD of some description. And they were given this at the height of the ceremonies, and it allowed them to reach a spiritual epiphany that was considered the high point of Greek society. You're only allowed to do it once, and most of the great Greeks did it. I mean, it ran for 2,000 years. It's hard to imagine anything running for 2,000 years these days.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, it's been the last 20 years now. It's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, there's a history of it within our own Western civilization as well. We just mostly abandoned it with the rise of Christianity.
Yeah. Thinking back, you know, granted I don't know every little tidbit of Christian history, but they never did use anything other than the bread and the wine in any of their ceremonies that I can think of. No conscious altering substances at all.
No, well, like I said, in the new world, or in the old world, sorry, especially in Europe, there's actually not a lot of naturally occurring entheogens. Most of the good ones, the powerful ones, are all in the new world. So maybe that was part of the problem. But the Greeks certainly used it, and of course in India they had Soma, which was considered to be the pinnacle of the Vedic civilization, and it was definitely a psychoactive brew of some kind. We just have no idea what it was.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, these plants have been around for a long time, and people like R. Gordon Basson and Terence McKenna have promoted the idea that this is actually where our spirituality began, that the accidental consumption of these plants led us to a whole new understanding of reality. That's a view I definitely subscribe to.
And what will a new understanding of reality bring us to? You know, a lot of people say that this whole 2012 thing, this doomsday deadline that's looming ever closer, is really no more than the end of an era and the beginning of a golden age. You know, well, do you see in, what is it, a little over 2 years that we could become a much more enlightened species?
Well, even if we did, we would face a whole lot of problems that are pretty hard to get by simply by being enlightened. The two main ones being the exponential growth of our population and the rapidly diminishing resources of the planet. So I tend to be a bit of a skeptic about the 2012 thing. I don't think there's ever been a successful date in history where there's ever been any obvious change. And I think if there has been a line drawn in the sand, we've already crossed it. Our civilization is rapidly heading towards a entropy watershed of almost unimaginable proportions. And I personally don't see a flowering of consciousness, like some people like Eckhart Tolle and other people who I respect very greatly their ideas. I just don't see how we get around the reality of the numbers. I tend to take more the view of someone like the American psychologist Abraham Maslow, who believed that 5% of any population of any species directs the evolution of that species. And I think there's going to be a very small number of us actually make the transition into the new age, golden or otherwise. And that seems to be a little dim view, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe that's what the 2012 is really all about. Maybe we're going to see our exponential population growth reach the breaking point at which we have a grand reduction. I mean, we've seen it with the populations of many species of animals.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, by my calculations, our society cannot go much past 2030. The decline of resources versus the growth of population is just too out of control. Everything's in decline while population's continuing to grow at an exponential rate. At some point, we're going to hit a wall that just doesn't work anymore, I think. The economic crisis of last year was a little bit of a taste of a lot of what's going to come.
Well, I don't know. Is the economic crash of last year is finished crashing yet?
No, you know, but it was the first signs of a planet
that seemed to be spreading out, you know?
Well, it was the first signs of a planet that needs to go into recession. We need to consume more. We need to make more. We need to actually start decreasing the size of our population sensibly and not increasing it. But the whole capitalist model is based on increased consumption. Every business must grow. Everything must produce more. So, you know, I don't know the kind of enlightenment that's going to come that's going to produce an economic theory that will replace capitalism. I certainly hope there's one.
Yeah. It'd be nice if we see some sort of a solution. Although I did have one person suggest that we were going to see a change in our economy, and because our economic system didn't work. and then proceeded to explain to me that everything was going to be free. And I said, well, wait a minute. Everything cannot be free, because even your own labor to produce something for yourself is a cost.
Yeah, I just got back from Burning Man where everything's free, and I tell you, it's not free. You got to work real hard.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I was like, you know, how are you going to get your electricity? How are you going to get your food? How are you going to make your food? How are you going to, you know, your clothes? Is someone going to just give them to you? Well, then it's still not free.
Well, just consider the fact we've considered 3.8 billion years worth of energy in 500 years.
Uh-huh.
Where does the bill total up for that? What are we leaving out? What are we leaving for the generations in the next 1,000 years? Nothing. So whatever life is on this planet, it's going to be occupying a much depleted planet compared to what we had only half a millennium ago.
You know, then you read about the sinking of New Orleans, and one of the contributing factors to its sinking is the extraction
of the oil.
Well,
not to mention the fact that they destroyed the wetlands, which really is what did the majority of the harm. The fact that the oil industry is not being made to pay for the restoration of New Orleans is a tragedy.
Well, you know, it kind of makes sense. If you layer anything and then you extract one of the layers beneath, even the top layer is going to...
Well, we're doing this stuff all over the planet. The reason we have these huge natural disasters now is because we've actually reshaped the way our population distributes on the planet. I mean, I was in Thailand when the tsunami hit, and the sad thing about that disaster is that 25 years ago, nobody lived in those zones. Tourism's pulled all the locals down to the low-lying coastal areas. And you see that all over. And just population, just the push of population. We're occupying land that we never used to occupy before. New Orleans survived a lot of hurricanes, and then in the 50s they decided to drain all the land between the lake and the French Quarter. So when you actually build a modern city in a soup bowl, you can't really be surprised when the bowl fills up. The oldest parts of town survived fine.
Yeah, and where I was at didn't flood at all, and the French Quarter didn't flood at all. And actually, I was told, and I did the comparison myself, if you look at the map of New Orleans from the mid-1800s, where people were living, and then compared it to what flooded post-Katrina.
Because they drained swamps.
Mm-hmm.
Which went back to being swamps.
Yeah.
There was a reason why the Broadmoor neighborhood was called Broadmoor. It used to be a Broadmoor, which is a lake, you know. But we're going to get those same mistakes all over the planet. We are getting that same mistake. I actually think because we're born in this phenomenal time of exponential change, there's a mechanism that's been created in our consciousness that allows us to operate, and I'm calling it extinction denial, because I think there's plenty of evidence. There's plenty of very smart people. James Lovelock, for example, the man who came up with the term Gaia, he has now said that we have done irreversible damage to the ecosphere. Now, whether he really believes that or not, whether it's just a warning to try and wake us up, let's really think about that. Some very smart people are saying we're in seriously, seriously deep trouble. I mean, I think the scale of people yelling at the top of their voice, we need to wake up, is unbelievable. But we can't wake up, because if we woke up, we'd all go mad and we wouldn't go to work tomorrow. So I think extinction denial is a very real thing.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I look at our state of affairs and I think, you know, we really haven't been too bright.
Yeah, that's about right, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, how's it all going to come out in the end? Well, you know, that's a good reason to keep on living each and every day, because that's the only way you're going to find out, you know?
And meanwhile, the same people are telling us that the technology that got us into this strife in the first place is somehow going to miraculously save us. Now, we have to learn to reuse our technology in a way that's balanced with the environment and life. And I think that's part of the reason that entheogens are important at the moment, is we need whatever means we have at our disposal to get back in touch with the sacred and get back in touch with God and really try and find balance with our environment again. Because I think one of the things that's really got us out of balance is our, we've made God and spirituality kind of a superstition over the last few hundred years. And now we need to reclaim God and create a metaphor that's worthy of our times. And I personally think that's a transcendental metaphor, because the experience that I've had on 5-MeO-DMT is practically identical to the experience that mystics have had throughout time, which is the experience of a void that's paradoxically a fullness, an energy field of information and a conscious energy field of information and energy that's somehow beyond thought, language, words. I think the transcendental ideal has always been there, and that's been the basis for all of our spirituality. And like the master mythologist Joseph Campbell writes, all the religions we've created are simply our cultural bound personifications of something that we can never really name. So we have to, as a planet, come to the recognition that all religion comes from one source, and that source is transcendental. And then once we can get back in touch with the transcendental, whether it's through meditation, prayer, chanting, or entheogens, then we can get back in touch really with reality, because our whole species spun off.
Yeah, but do you see, and to me a lot of this, my religion is better than your religion, is no different than my daddy can kick your daddy's butt. I'm not seeing that people are really going to cooperate much with losing that. I mean, they're just...
Well, they need to have first-hand experiences.
And how are you going to convince them to do that? I mean, after all...
Legalizing entheogens and setting up a system of legal ritual would be probably a good start.
Well, making it legal is one thing. Getting people to not regard it as something bad, 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 shouldn't do that, is another.
Well, I would have been a total skeptic prior to my experience. Like I said, I would probably not even be able to listen to this interview. I'd think this guy was nuts. But it turned me around, and I tend to have a pretty hard head. So, and there's plenty of experiences in the written record throughout history where it's happened to other people. I mean, like I said, I don't have a particularly bright view of the future. I don't necessarily think the majority of humanity is going to make the next transition. So I think perhaps it'll only be the very small percentage that wake up to the idea of a transcendental vision of spirituality and try and actually go beyond the religions we currently have, which are only offering us mostly warfare and strife all over the planet. And, maybe that will be the seed of the next paradigm that will exist on this planet.
Yeah. I guess I'm a little...
skeptical?
More than a little skeptical. Having lived most of my life in the Bible Belt, the idea of having legal ceremonies and trying to convince people to come to them, I'm just seeing somebody getting tarred and feathered or burned at stake or something equally vile.
You could be right. But if you believe, if I believe what Abraham Maslow proposes, it's only 5% of us that are going to direct the future of humanity anyway. So I'm not trying to turn the whole world on. I'm definitely more of the Aldous Huxley approach than of the Timothy Leary approach. I think you have to be somewhat spiritually and philosophically prepared to really have the mystical experience happen to you anyway. I didn't believe in God, but I'd spent a lot of my life traveling around the world experiencing different things, and I think I was just fortunate enough to be wide open enough to allow the experience to really take me. I don't think it's going to happen to everyone. In my book, I say I only believe that it happens to 5% of the people that even smoke 5-MeO-DMT. But even if it happens to just a few of us, It produces an actual measurable amount of energy into the world. something that the radical Christians these days call liberation theology, which is the idea that when you have a true spiritual epiphany, there's a composition of it that's both mystical and political. So you come out of the experience somewhat compelled with a responsibility to try and make positive change. And I definitely feel that I've been through that. And in liberation theology, they call it contemplative activism. And you can say that the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, Thomas Merton, Martin Luther King Jr., the 20th century, we had a number of powerful contemplative activists. And maybe that's just what we need for the future. We need more of these, you know, people that genuinely believe that they have encountered an energy within them that is compelling them to create change.
Well, okay, you know, in primitive societies, the ones that, you know, have this long tradition of using these substances, even within those groups, not everybody uses them, do they?
Depends on the tribes. There are some tribes that use them. Pretty, yeah. Often the women don't get to do them. But the thing is, I don't really identify so much with shamanism. I think one of the reasons that shamanism is so popular, these ideas about shamanism are so popular right now, shamanism is a technology. And the shaman's basically a technician. He uses ayahuasca very much as a tool. I think I'm more interested in mysticism, because mysticism is not a technology. Mysticism is dealing with something that's actually outside of our understanding, if you like. So it's a bit of a different thing. I certainly consider myself more of a modern mystic than any kind of a shaman.
Well, yeah, you know, I can understand that. I guess what I was getting at is, you know, when we were talking about that, most of the people just aren't going to get it. That, you know, a lot of people accuse me of intellectual elitism at this point. But there's always been a smaller percentage of people within societies that possess the bulk of the knowledge.
Yeah, for sure.
Whether it was spiritual knowledge, medicinal knowledge, or whatever kind of knowledge.
Well, there are people that argue that, you know, thanks to the internet, we're actually living in a time where knowledge is able to be distributed in a way it never has before. And I think there's a certain truth to that. But knowledge is kind of hollow without the reality of experience. I think it was Herman Zimmer who said a remembered truth is a dead thing. And
well,
it's contradictory, but you have to actually experience something to really believe it.
Yeah, that's true. But in addition, you can show people things, and many times they refuse to see. It's that old saying about you can lay the horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
I agree 100%, and I wrote my book for the people that have had my experience, not for the people that haven't. It's actually kind of written looking to see who's out there that's been through what I've been through. And I've been around the country this summer giving my little presentations, and there's at least one or two people come up to me each time and go, yep, I've been to exactly where you went. I have my a camp at Burning Man, and there was a girl at our camp who was camping with us, and she found a copy of the book, sat down, read about 5 chapters of it, and then found out that the author was asleep in his art car about 25 yards away. She waited for 6 hours for me to wake up, and then she was just so excited to talk to me. It turned out that she had smoked 5-MeO-DMT twice, and from her description, she'd had very similar experiences to mine, which she described as going to heaven. And when she started telling her other friends tried it as well, but they didn't have the same kind of experiences. So when she started telling people that she wasn't afraid of dying and that she was looking forward to death, and which, you know, I understand that because I went through the same thing. It's not like you want to die, but you have zero fear of death anymore because you know that death is a continuation. As Vladimir Nabokov wrote, life has been a great surprise, and I suspect that death shall be also. Well, that's exactly what you feel like after you come back from 5-MeO-DMT, which mimics the near-death experience in a lot of ways. It's very interesting stuff. Now, we haven't really gone into the way 5-MeO-DMT works. But one of the interesting things about it is not only is it found in plants and in the venom of a toad, but it's also found endogenously within the human body, which means the human body is producing both DMT and 5-MeO-DMT from within ourselves, which is very unique. And the molecule is very similar to serotonin. And it's because of the shape of the molecule that it's able to cross the blood-brain barrier. Little carrier molecules actually come and grab it and take it across the most sophisticated barrier we have in the human body that only allows basic sugars like glucose and important brain hormones like serotonin or melatonin to cross.
Uh-huh.
So here we're dealing with two compounds that are keyly linked to our consciousness, and the fact that such powerful antigens exist within the body is a tremendous mystery to a lot of people. Dr. Rick Strassman wrote a book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule, which is about his experiments with DMT in a DEA-approved study in the University of New Mexico in 1990. And anybody interested in the subject should definitely check that book out. It's very interesting. Dr. Strassman's theory is that DMT is the vehicle with which the soul enters and leaves the body, which is a pretty radical proposition. So we're dealing with a class of compounds that's very unique and definitely is worthy of much more investigation and study, even than what I'm talking about using it ritually, but it needs to be being studied in universities, it needs to be being studied by psychiatrists. There's something to the mystery of existence contained within these compounds, and they should be being prized, not being illegal. The fact that something that's produced by our own body is illegal is pretty hilarious in itself. We're all walking crime scenes, according to the DEA.
At the same time, now, when these substances are synthesized and taken as a pill form without any ceremonies, they still have the same effect, is what I'm understanding you saying.
They can. These substances are actually smoked, generally. You don't take them as pills. In my case, I was lucky enough that I got the realization with no ritual involved. And I think that was probably part of my success, was because it was like Zen lightning. It was so unexpected. I couldn't ignore it. But I think there's plenty of proof that that ritual spaces and intention work well in entheogens. Timothy Leary pointed out the value of set and setting. And I think if governments and parents and organizations are worried about their use and legalization, then why not allow them to be used in a controlled way? If not by a spiritual group, then allow psychiatrists to administer it, or people want to go that route and experiment, they should be allowed to. There's no case that DMT or 5-MeO-DMT has ever seriously hurt anybody's... Well, no, actually, that's not true. There have been some cases that, because it is so powerful, where people have suffered from damage to their psyche that's lasted weeks, months, even years. But the cases are very rare. And one could argue that they are partially due to the fact that there's so little information available about these compounds, so when people try them, they really don't know what they're getting themselves into.
Well, yeah, a lot of times, people do bite off more than they are ready to deal with and get a big surprise.
I had absolutely no idea what 5-MeO-DMT would do to me. And it's so different to anything else I've ever experienced, there was no way I could have known. But when I went looking afterwards for information about the compound, there was very, very little, which is why I ended up writing this book. And I actually wrote the book, I don't know if you know this, but I wrote the book as a contribution to the Burning Man art movement. I'm not sure what you know about Burning Man. It's a festival that is in the Nevada desert every year, just ended.
Yeah, on Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, it's a big counterculture gathering, and I've been a keen participant in it for several years, so I thought I would write a book for where I thought was probably the most receptive population to my story, and I wrote it and gifted it on the flyer in 2006 and 2007. some 500 copies. And then seven revisions and three editors later, much to my amazement, it's been published by Inner Traditions. So it's managed to leap
it's a beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it is. I love the cover on it. The Sonoran Desert Toad. Now, I lived on the Sonoran Desert for, 15 years or so, 15, 20 years.
And that's
I never
babies.
Saw a toad colored quite like that. So I'm
assuming. Well, that's a bit of a mad artist rendition, but in a tradition.
Okay, okay. Yeah,
he doesn't look much like that.
No, I remember these large toads that.
Yeah, you also call them the Colorado River Toad.
Yeah, they were very irritating because they would bury themselves in your garden and then come out when you were watering, and they leave large holes behind them, and you could lose a lot of water down in one of their holes.
Yeah, that's why the ancient people thought they were otherworldly, because they would materialize out of the mud.
Well, they bury themselves deep in mud to, get through the long droughts. And believe me, on the desert, they're long, all right? And then when you're artificially watering, of course, they're attracted because, A, it's fresh water and mud, and, B, there's bugs. So, they come to hang out in your garden.
They're fantastic animals. They're the only animal on Earth that produces a true entheogen in its venom up to 15% by volume. All other entheogens on this planet are contained within plants, or, as it turns out, within our human brain.
I know that I'm very familiar with what a dog looks like when it grabs one of these toads.
I've told they can become addicted to licking them.
Usually there's problems with paralysis and foaming at the mouth. It has been known to kill dogs, even.
We have its close cousin in the Dominican Republic, the Bufo marinus. And I know that the dogs in my neighborhood can actually get hooked on chasing them around and getting buzzed. Pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
There's a whole chapter in my book where I deal, a lot of people believe that the Indians smoke the toad venom. And there's actually no evidence of this whatsoever.
So now you're going to tell me the Indians were out in the desert licking toads?
No, potentially milking the venom.
Uh-huh.
But there's a fascinating paper written by Wade Davis and Andrew Wheel, and they trace the relationship with the Mayan civilization, which I know you're a great fan of from your introduction.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting is the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Olmecs all venerated the Bufo toad, and they use it all over their art. There's a massive sculpture of a Bufo toad in the Anthropological Museum in Mexico City, which I like to go and see every time I'm down there.
Uh-huh.
Definitely one of the great museums of the world. And it clearly shows on the sculpture the partoid glands and the places on the toad where you would milk the venom. Now, anthropologists have always assumed that the Mayans somehow used the Bufo marinus, which is the Florida cane toad type of toad, which is the one that the whole myth about toad licking arose. Toad licking is totally invented by the media, and the sorry cases that have actually done it have done so after they read about it in the newspaper, it seems.
Uh-huh.
The only use of toads in this way that we know of is you milk the venom over a pane of glass, and in the morning it dries into a crystal that looks as synthetic as anything you've ever seen in a lab. Wade Davis, you may know, he's the National Explorer in Residence at National Geographic. Fascinating guy. They proposed that the toad that the Mayans and the Aztecs venerated was not actually the Bufo marinus, but the Bufo alvarius, which is the Sonoran Desert Toad. Because the Aztecs were originally a tribe called the Ute, who came down out of northern Mexico and conquered the entire territory. And these guys proposed that that toad venom would have been highly valuable and was probably the only thing they had to offer to trade from the northern desert. And the reason it seems feasible to me is, the Bufo marinus, the cane toad that they assume that the Mayans used, and there's a lot of papers been written about this, is totally poisonous. And really won't get you any kind of an entheogenic experience other than maybe near death or even dying. Now, in Mexico, they have more top-notch entheogens than anywhere else in the world. They've got magic mushrooms, they've got the olokoi seed, Trichrealis D, they got peyote, they got all these fabulous natural entheogens that are non-poisonous. Why would they venerate something that obviously was, no good? So it makes a lot more sense that they were actually smoking the toad venom, which would produce an effect more powerful than the other natural entheogens they had. And let's not forget, the Indians believed that smoke was a sacred vessel, was a sacred carrier, a vessel. So they were pretty into smoke and stuff.
Yeah.
In South America, ayahuasca, which is a brew, contains mostly DMT and occasionally a little bit of 5-MeO-DMT. But the snuffs, which is when they take a hollow bird's leg and they blow a powdered bark down your nose, is pure 5-MeO-DMT, which is what the subject of my book is about. And Jonathan Ott, who's one of the leading experts on the use of these entheogens in native cultures, he believes that the snuff use predates the ayahuasca use, and that the shaman somehow intuited the formula for the more complex ayahuasca after 1,000 years of using the snuff.
Well, I know that I had a previous guest on, and his name is escaping me. Tyndall was his last name, come to think of it. His name is Robert Tyndall. Anyhow, he talked about people when they were using ayahuasca as an experiment, actually were able to find answers to questions and shorten research in other areas.
Was it Jeremy Nabi?
Pardon?
Was it Jeremy Nabi?
I don't recall the name of the person that he was referring to, but the name of the author was...
There's a Swiss-Canadian anthropologist called Jeremy Nabi, who's written a book called The Cosmic Serpent. And it's about ayahuasca, and he believes that our DNA transmits information through biophotonic emission through the use of ayahuasca. And that was actually the starting point for some of my theories that of how the entheogenic experience actually originates in the zero-point field, which is another big chunk of my book, which we haven't got to yet.
Well, we probably won't get to it all. Your book is way too complex to be covered in a matter of 2 hours.
Tell me about
it.
I've been sitting down for the last few days preparing my presentation for Symbiosis, the festival out here in California, near Yosemite. I'm going to be speaking on Friday at 9:30 after Alex Gray. And, 5 years of investigations to try and get down into a two-hour presentation is a pretty difficult thing.
It's a very difficult thing. And, when you have to narrow it down and just select the portion of the information, it makes it even more difficult.
Yeah.
And the author was Robert Tyndall, and the book that he had written was called The Jaguar That Roams the Mind.
Oh, yeah, that would be
actually, right. Yeah, it's actually about his personal experiences.
Excellent.
And I found that a very interesting book.
Yeah, the shamans believe that they can turn into jaguars while they're on ayahuasca. But
it was a good book, and it presented the information in a different way about things I really hadn't thought about before.
There's a famous exchange between Richard Evans Schultes, who was the plant explorer who first discovered ayahuasca and classified it as Banisteriopsis caffi, and a Colombian German anthropologist called Reichert Dortmoff, who wrote a lot of the early stuff about ayahuasca. And sometime in the 60s, these two were introduced at a conference. And Schultes is famous for having done ayahuasca a bunch of times and never had anything happen to him. And I'm actually a bit the same. I've done it a couple of times in Peru and Ecuador, and it doesn't do a whole lot to me other than make me sick. I think people have very different body chemistries and just need different amounts or different tolerances or whatever. But for whatever reason, Richard Evans Schulte's never really got off on it. And then he meets this Colombian German anthropologist who's written a whole book, which is the first book about the jaguars and how jaguars and serpents appear to be shamans. So he goes to Schulte's when they're introduced. He goes, "Well, you know, did you see the jaguars?" And Schulte goes, no, nothing but colours and squiggly lines." And the guy goes, Reichhoff Dotloff goes, "But have you not done the ayahuasca? You know, have you not experienced the brew?" And Schulte's is like, "Yep, I'm the one that named it, you know." And the anthropologist just stormed off in disgust. And you'll have nothing more to do with them, which I think is a good example of how there are definitely different viewpoints can exist, and it's important to try and recognise both ends of the extreme. I've tried really hard in my book to look at many, many ideas and then narrow them down to the ones that seem to be the most valid or which have the most supportive evidence. I think there's a lot of stuff out there that's based on very flimsy evidence. So it's good to search through your information and really try and weigh it out, decide how real you really think these things are, because there's so much information out there these days, it's hard to tell heads from tails sometimes.
Well, yeah. You were talking earlier about the internet, and, we can get overwhelmed by information, too.
Well, and there's a ton of information on the internet that's just not right. And there's no way...
A lot of it's utter garbage, and people don't realize that.
There's no way of filtering what's wrong or right on the internet other than backing it up, probably in a genuine library.
Yeah.
I was very lucky I had John Hanna, who was the editor, who was with Arrowhead and does the Mind States conference. And he was my first editor when I was preparing the book for self-publication. And he's a real hard-headed facts kind of a guy. So he keeps beating me down and anything that smelled of airy-fairy hippiness.
Uh-huh.
I think that was good for the book, because I think it makes the book a lot solider.
Well, hippiness, as you put it, a lot of times turns people off. People who are more... data-oriented don't want to hear about new-age ideas.
Well, yeah, a lot of the things I talk about are pretty far out there, but they're generally far out there from within our sciences, as opposed to being far out there with no kind of, evidence backing them up. I find it interesting. I think in some ways hippiness is very popular. People seem more willing to talk about transmissions from the Pleiades or 2012 or a lot of these other things than they're willing to talk about the discoveries of science.
I find
the discoveries of science fascinating these days.
Oh, I think a lot of times they're more willing to talk about things that they at the same time poo-poo because they regard them as non-threatening ideas.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of truth to that.
You could talk about it and somewhat ridicule it and entertain it, but in a lighthearted way. You don't have to be serious about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basic. People aren't really that keen on being serious these days. It can lead to insanity.
Well, seriousness is, that's your credit cards and your credit rating and your mortgage. That's serious. Everything else is, another category, I guess. But anyhow, hang on to your thoughts, everyone. It is time for us to take a break. So stay tuned, and the Dawn of Shades will be right back with James Orrick. welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit the website, www.exogenatenetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, let me know what you think of it. There are links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you have a question that you wish to have asked, you can email it to me at giascott@gmail.com. I'm monitoring the email during the program with James Orrick tonight, and I'm going to try real hard not to miss a thing. If you are in the virtual auditorium, you can send it to me in text. If you just type it on the main screen, I might miss it. James, before we start on any topic, though, do please tell the audience about your website and where to get your book.
Well, currently I don't have a website, but it's the next thing I've got to get organized. But you can find my book on the Inner Traditions website, and it's pretty much available everywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble's, but I would encourage you all to support your local bookstore.
Yeah, if you still have a local bookstore. A lot of people don't have them anymore.
I understand. So if you got one, try and hang on to it.
Yeah, that's a valuable resource. I miss the ones that I was so fond of. When I lived in Arizona, Flagstaff had a couple of really great bookstores.
One of the many tragedies of globalization.
Yep, seeing the changes in our shopping habits. Although I've been advocating strongly, support your local businesses, you know, right down to the farmer's market level. That's been my personal crusade here lately.
I think that's
getting
going on a lot
book.
All over the country.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing is that if you eat local foods, you are reducing your carbon footprint, you might say, because that food's not being shipped in from who knows where, and you're supporting your local economy from the farmers to on up. So it's a great thing.
Yeah, it's even happening at the civic level. A friend of mine, Renette Serum, is the mayor of Grass Valley, California, and she's pushing at that level very hard to make the whole area a local economy.
I got a recent email about support, you know, your regional manufacturers. You know, a lot of products are, you know, one factory produces for several states. And if you have a choice of peanut butter that's made in your area from peanuts grown in your area versus peanuts that are made clear across the country, or peanut butter that's made clear across the country, it does make sense to buy the local product.
Well, maybe we should make the FDA put that on the label as well.
Oh, I got a whole long list of Southern companies that was sent to me. Yeah, it was like, oh, boy, y'all are going to make me have to take a list with me to the grocery store so I know who I'm buying the peanut butter from, even.
Yeah, it's getting to that point.
Yeah, you know, grocery shopping is not as easy as it used to be.
No doubt. Try and find something without high fructose corn syrup in it.
Oh, yeah, I have a diabetic daughter, so I have a long experience with looking for the hidden carbohydrates.
I'll have to come shopping with you sometime.
It can get quite tricky because, I have to use reading glasses now, and I have to use them. And they put that, I swear they're putting those ingredients in ever smaller type. I should take two pair with me to the store.
Modern living is extraordinarily complex.
Yeah, it used to be peanut butter was, guess what, peanuts ground up into butter. No, now it has a long list of ingredients. Bread used to be flour, yeast, salt, water, maybe some kind of fat, maybe some milk, maybe some eggs. No, now it's a long list of unpronounceable things that you're not sure what the heck it is. And I have food allergies, too, so, you know, there again, I had to look for the hidden thing.
Yeah, there's a great thing on YouTube called Did You Know? And if you've heard about that, it's a bunch of statistics that was presented, I think, to the G9 conference last year or some big conference.
Uh-huh.
And it basically points out what an exponential age we're living in, and it has all these amazing statistics. But one of them that I remember was that a couple of pages of the Sunday issue of the New York Times contained more information in it than the average human in the 1800s would find in their entire lifetime. So it really shows you that we're living in this. I think that's
but
part of the problem.
At the same time, have you seen any of... I read a test for someone to graduate the 8th grade in some small town in Kansas, okay? So we're not talking about some famous school. Do you know, and I'm considered moderately well-educated, better than average, but not as well-educated as some. I couldn't have even come close to passing that test after a lifetime of knowledge.
Must be an interesting school. When you consider the fact the average newspaper is now written to be read by, what is it, a 9-year-old?
And the thing is that it wasn't necessarily that the information was so complex, but it was things that maybe we just don't bother learning anymore.
Well, we've got food that has compounds in it that's like 19 syllables that you've never heard of.
Yeah, but don't ask me to conjugate a verb.
You turn off, don't you? There's a point where we receive information overload. And I think that's one of the reasons our population's so easy to manipulate and control these days.
Yeah, and, you know, so often I've seen bits of false information just be swallowed by a huge group of people without even questioning it.
Yeah, well, we just saw that from the Bush administration, I think.
Okay.
You gotta tell a lie, tell a big one. Goebbels said that.
Yeah, and I don't think politicians in general, you know, they seem to have perfected that particular art.
Well, I think our system has perfected the art of control using our food, using television, using, you know, this myth of a two-party system as if you had some kind of a choice. I mean, when we grew up, you know, we were told that the Soviet Union was such a terrible place because they controlled the media and they controlled the information and they controlled the way what people thought, what they ate, you know. And the fact is,
so if you look back to the, say 1600s in Europe, the information was controlled.
It's always been controlled.
Yeah, the media was controlled. Now, granted, the media was your local priest, but he was still under control.
Well, I think
was controlled by the local lord, you know, and so forth and so on. And so, really, we're kind of going back to the basics, you might say.
That we've evolved in such sophistication that we can give the illusion of freedom, even though it's totally controlled.
Exactly.
Like, you know, the world that George Orwell predicted in 1984, he thought it would be forcibly made to sit in front of a TV screen and pump full of drugs to get indoctrinated. But the fact is, Americans do that every day and think that's their
not
rights,
all of them.
Their freedom.
I don't have television, but my television hasn't been turned on for 2 years. It's got more dust on it. It's got enough dust on it, I can start growing a crop, I think.
I don't get time to watch much TV. I like True Blood, though.
it's just a case for me of, I have to pick and choose what I'm going to do. And television is the passive activity that A, requires I sit there mesmerized by that screen, and B, I'm not really interacting with it. So it kind of got, I broke TV habit in the 70s, and I just never really got into it again.
I think one of the best things about writing my book was I often describe it as the greatest intellectual experiment, you know, or experience of my life, because my experiences on fighting the ADMT really forced me to go out and look for knowledge. And I've been an extreme sports journalist for a number of years, and I've got a book of short stories called Passport to Argosia, which is about to be republished, as well as a novel I've been working on for some time. So this is not like it's the first time that I've written, but this is definitely the first book that has got published by a major publisher. And it, you know, it was just an amazing adventure as I got to rediscover all these great minds like Aldous Huxley, David Bohm, Irvin Laszlo, the Shulgins. There's this great list of, I have a very long bibliography in my book because I literally read
hundreds of books over a five-year period to try and understand what I'd been through. And I think anything, any compound that excites your intellect that much should be considered a good thing.
Yeah, well, I find this program kind of does that to me. First of all, you know, I read a lot of books, and I talk to a lot of people with specific areas of expertise or knowledge. So, and, you know, we have to, you know, do a web, we do a web page, because you've got a page on our website now, and so forth and so on. So you have to pay attention. Now, even though I have help with some of this stuff, I still have to know it, too. So it makes me learn new things and look at new ideas.
George Clinton from the band Parliament Funkadelic says, you can't afford free speech, so you might as well pay attention. I think you're right. Paying attention is a very important thing.
Yeah, you do. You have to pay attention. And paying attention, you know, I notice it, like we were talking on break, you know, I'm fond of camping, okay? And I find that when I get out in the outdoors, first of all, it's like I'm at home here, you know. I don't have to listen for traffic. I'm listening for other things, things that make sense to me. And I love watching, when I'm taking somebody else out there, to watch them and see what they notice and what they don't notice about the world around them.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on.
Yeah.
No matter what ecology, you know, what ecological area you're involved in, there is so much going on. There's the plants, there's the bugs, there's the birds, there's the animals, there's things that creep around, you know. And it is. It's fascinating to me.
I love the accounts from plant explorers and anthropologists like Wade Davis who talk about, you know, having been in the Amazon many times over a number of years, and yet when they're in the company of the local Indians, they're like stampeding buffalo, you know. The Indians see so much more and move so much more gently through the environment. Well, we're literally aliens down there.
Well, when I first moved to Louisiana, the alien experience really, really came home to me, because coming from a family that, you know, their entire livelihood was based on the desert, you knew everything about it. You knew what the rocks told you, the dirt told you, the plants told you, the animals told you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly I'm plunged into a world that is so unlike that. I didn't know any of the plants. There are no rocks in Louisiana. You know, it's full of water. Instead of water being something you look for, water is everywhere.
Louisiana
and there's
the opposite
monsters
of
in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was like being moved to an alien planet. I didn't even know the trees.
Well, I'd have to say, if there really are any aliens living on Earth, they're probably living in the French Quarter, because down there they could get away with it.
I did tell somebody, you know, I don't care how weird you want to dress, you can go down to the French Quarter and nobody will blink an eye.
Gotta love it.
Yeah. And that's another place. It's fun to take people from a much more conservative world, to put it quite politely, and take them down to the French Quarter and watch their eyes bug out, because, especially during Mardi Gras, you know, that's one of my right now I'm on the verge of laughing just remembering, you know, taking somebody down there, and as we're walking down the street, here comes some guy, and he's got the butt cut out of his pants, and he's replaced it with clear plastic. And to me, it was like, oh,
well, most
you know, whatever.
Don't even do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was fairly, this was a fairly conservative thing,
yeah.
I thought. I mean, it wasn't an eye blinker even. And, you know, before we'd made it two blocks, I thought any minute now we're going to see foam erupting from, you know, this guy's mouth. Because this was just so far out of his realm of normal that it was shocking him. You know,
well, I always say New Orleans is not really part of America. You know, its history is 150 years older than the United States. It was well established by the time it got brought into the United States. And it's more like Cuba or Colombia,
well,
or somewhere like that.
A lot of people assume that New Orleans has a draw. No, they don't. They don't sound like the rest of Louisiana, and they don't sound like the rest of the Gulf Coast.
No, New Orleans people have a pretty clean accent.
They, you know, their accent's entirely different, and the closest American accent is the Boston accent.
Yeah, where you at?
Yeah, where you at?
You're making me homesick for one of my many adopted homes.
New Orleans is a place that I don't care how long you lived here or stayed here. When you move on, you're always going to miss it, I think.
Yeah, it gets in your blood. And it's not going away.
Yeah, it is. It's a special place. Whether you want to attribute it to ley lines or energies or spiritual influences or the ghosts of Christmas past, whatever you want to chalk it up to, it's got its own... spirit, in a sense, too.
Yeah, no doubt. Thick with it. The Grigory.
Well, I have to admit, one of my favorite things is to, in the wintertime, to be down in the French Quarter in the evening, you know, it's dark, and the fog comes rolling in off of the river, and it entirely changes the French Quarter. It becomes so surreal. You know, in a sense, it's kind of spooky. In another sense, it's just it's nature's art, you know. I don't know. It's really, really a fascinating experience to sit, you know, like Jackson Square, Cafe du Monde, or whatever, watch the fog roll in, and then just walk around on the streets because the fog muffles sounds. It restricts your field of vision. You can only see so far, so you're not distracted by too much visual. Stimuli, you might say, and it is a different thing.
There's plenty of stimuli down there. Since we're talking about New Orleans, can I read you an account out of my book, which is probably the strangest 5-MeO DMT experience I've ever had?
Go ahead.
It actually happened in New Orleans. This is read straight out of my book. The 5-MeO DMT experience began at close to midnight on October 30th in New Orleans, in a neighborhood famous for its association with Haitian voodoo. I was with an old friend, Renee, a middle-aged Canadian woman long experienced in the ways of the counterculture, having spent many years in California and having worked as a photographer with the Grateful Dead for 8 years. She had smoked 5-MeO DMT once and was keen to do so again, but she was happy for me to lead the way. Renee doesn't smoke weed, had not been drinking, and thus was completely sober at the point when I inhaled the 5-MeO DMT while sitting cross-legged on a couch opposite her. On this occasion, I sailed through the usual progression of steps, and I remember hitting the stage during which the enormity of the knowledge and the timeless nature of my environment usually would frighten me into a return to my physical form. I recall opening my eyes at that point, and in an unusual moment of physical clarity, I saw that Renee was sitting across from me meditating. I felt that everything was okay, sailed straight through that stage, which is usually my peak, and burst into a realm that can only be described as pure light. But this was no ordinary white light, for even the white tunnel that I dissolve into when I exhale from a 5-MeO hit normally, instead it was a fractal-filled prismatic light of indescribable radiance and beauty that pulsed with its own intelligence. I remember this all with remarkable accuracy. I then felt a strong sense of the presence of my friend Bridget, who had died several years earlier. I loved Bridget very much, yet I realized I had not thought about her in quite some time, perhaps because my thoughts had been overwhelmed by my fascination with my new world. But now she was clearly in my consciousness, and it was much more than a sense of simply remembering her. It was as if we were walking together, hand in hand, through towering shadowy trees on a field of stars, and she was laughing, her smile radiant. This was not a memory, but a feeling of actually being there with her, something I'd never experienced before. The next thing I knew, I found myself back in normal reality, lying peacefully on the sofa, and feeling totally calm and incredibly straight, after which was my least tumultuous return from the Tryptamine Palace. And all I said was, I just remembered an old friend. At this point, Renee came over and sat down beside me where I lay, and gripped my arm quite hard. I realized that her face was covered with tears. There was a woman in the room, she said, as she wrung her hands with her eyes closed, seemingly occupying some place between two worlds.
She was young and beautiful. Oh, she seemed like she was so much fun. She was laughing, and she wanted to tell you that she was sorry that she did not get a chance to say goodbye, and that she loves you. She's still here, but she's fading away. Renee went on to accurately describe my dead friend's appearance and personality, though she did not know her at all and had never met her. She was obviously agitated and very emotional. It was as though she had taken some kind of a drug, and it took many hours before she completely came down. Renee's version of the events went like this. After I exhaled the 5-MeO-DMT, she saw a beam of light the size of an American quarter come out of my chest. When I split into two perfect copies of myself, sitting side by side on the couch, she found it hard to believe what she was seeing, being completely straight at the time. She said that even though she opened and closed her eyes and rubbed them, the vision continued, apparently for a period of several minutes. After a while, she decided to close her eyes and meditate, since the whole affair was freaking her out a little. This is when the spirit of my dead friend suddenly appeared, an encounter Renee described in convincing detail. Renee is a mother with a grown son, and she was completely sober during my trip. But if you had walked into the room while she was relaying what had happened to you, you would have sworn that she had taken some kind of a drug and that I was the sober one. She has had considerable experience with people on all kinds of chemicals during her 50-plus years on the planet, and yet it is safe to say that she has never experienced anything like this before. Now, it's worth mentioning that Renee has lived in California for some years, and she is receptive to various New Age concepts, far more so than I am. She has had other channeling experiences and comes from a long line of women known to possess fey powers. So she was later able to take the whole bizarre metaphysical occurrence somewhat in stride. I, on the other hand, had no idea what to think, since I did not at this time believe in life after death, and certainly not in a form coherent enough to be able to wish me goodbye. Yet there was Renee shaking and crying and describing Bridget, the same person I have just been walking with in another dimension, in fairly astonishing detail. To this day, I still do not know what to think or to believe. The veil between the worlds is thin in New Orleans, the most magic-believing city in North America. And people who really put stock in such things claim that around All Saints' Eve, the veil barely exists at all. I've always felt that I had a strange karmic telepathic bond with my beautiful friend, whom I had been with for the last time in New Orleans several years earlier. A few years later, I attended my first Mardi Gras. Early on its climatic final day, Fat Tuesday, I was standing on the street watching the Zulu parade when a sudden deep depression descended upon me, causing me to cry real tears for no apparent reason. My friends were concerned, but I managed to shake off this dark, severe feeling and made it through the rest of the day with a general sense of unease, as if something really wrong had just happened in the world. The following week, I telephoned my homeland in the South Pacific to check on a pair of old friends who were expecting a baby, since I was worried that this was might have been the source of my concern. Upon hearing that their bouncing baby boy had been delivered premature but fine, I breathed a sigh of relief. Then I asked, for no real reason, if my friends had seen Bridget recently. Complete silence was the response from the end of the phone before my friend told me that Bridget had died suddenly of a brain embolism. He assumed that I had already heard. She had died on what had been, on the other side of the world in New Orleans, Mardi Gras Day. Coincidences like these occur naturally enough in life and can easily be discredited by logical disbelievers. I certainly would not consider this a proof of any kind. But whatever happened between Renee and me, and who knows what other cosmic force, while I was under the influence of a brain full of 5-MeO-DMT is a much harder experience to discredit. Did the spirit of my deceased friend enter the room? Or did my mind, supercharged from 3 months of regular 5-MeO-DMT smoking, project that image into the ether? And if this is so, then why is my recollection one of walking and laughing with Bridget, with no sense of her wishing to tell me anything? Yet Renee delivered a clear message that could only make sense to me, since she had no idea of Bridget's former existence. All in all, this was a very heavy experience, and I decided to take a break from tryptamine smoking for a while so that I could have adequate time to reflect on the variety of possibilities that this experience had opened up. Like I said, I still don't really know what I think, but this is the type of experience that places 5-MeO-DMT in a realm of its own as far as I'm concerned. I don't consider 5-MeO-DMT to be a drug. Rather, it is a sacrament of some kind and is best used and respected in such contexts.
Smoking 5-MeO-DMT up to this point had been mind-blowing good fun and spiritually enlightening enough to make me believe in the existence of God. But after this experience in New Orleans, my interpretation and understanding of what was happening while I was under the influence of 5-MeO-DMT took on a deeper meaning. It's been several years now since that night, and as I sit here writing these words, I still question what really happened that evening, as I have questioned it 1,000 times before. Whose energy was at work in that room? What did Renee see while I lay there in the depths of my experience? Yet I know in my heart and my mind that it all happened. It was, in Ludwig Wittgenstein's marvelous phrase, true enough. And no amount of reading, tryptamine smoking, or sitting at Rinpoche's feet is likely to ever to be able to explain it much better than the little I already know. It was the profoundest glimpse of an ancient, unheralded reality that our contemporary society is mostly too blind to see, an encounter that today we dismiss as myth, fantasy, or even schizophrenia, and one that cannot be easily classified by modern entheogenic lore. So after that experience, my spiritual and intellectual progress had no choice but to step away from the futuristic and the fantastic, as my search moved on to both a careful examination of our sciences and to the volumes that have been written by those men and women who have similarly drunk from the mystic's cup throughout the ages. So, I would have to say that was definitely my most inexplicable and deeply personal experience, and it definitely sent me off on a whole different realm of discovery.
Yeah, I have to admit, in New Orleans, strange things can happen.
Yeah.
My mother claims that as a child I was always a ghost magnet, but there have been times that I've done the double take and, you know, I don't know what I've seen. Was there something floating on the surface of my eye? I keep telling myself it was. It just happened to look like a person, right?
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, you see some very, very strange things on occasion, and altered state of consciousness, I can easily see where something like what happened with you could very easily happen.
Yeah. Like I said, that's still outside of the real boundaries of my investigation. I don't really know what to make of it, but it was so deeply personal that it had to make me. A lot of the things that happen to you on 5-MeO-DMT are not recreational. You know, they're serious things that make you really look inside your soul and your mind and try.
I've heard of people who had experiences that included talking with some authoritarian sort of figure. Whether you want to call it Jesus, God, or King Tut, or whatever name you want to put on this figure. Sometimes it's been a group of these authoritative figures. And sometimes you're getting judged, too.
Yeah, I think that's more common on DMT than 5-MeO-DMT. DMT tends to project you more into a realm of imagery, where 5-MeO-DMT will actually project you past that into what the Hindus would say the realm of the seventh chakra, the realm of the transcendent, where literally the barrier between you and God evaporates and you essentially become one with God. You experience this tremendous transpersonal oneness with the entire universe and everything that's in it and everything that's been in it and everything that will be in it. And this is an experience that's been commonly reported by mystics since the beginning of time, often not with the use of entheogens. I think we've developed such a powerful ego consciousness that we've lost a lot of contact with the lower levels or the level of mind that exists in all things. Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Awakening, has some very interesting ideas about the ego structure that I think fit in very well.
Here lately I've been entertaining a thought. You know, when you watch a child maturing, they don't mature in all ways evenly and equally. And just like a child, humanity does not mature in all ways equally.
No, we're not living in a system that's encouraging us to mature.
Right. We've lived so much in the physical world. We've focused so much on science and material gains, technology, that sort of thing, that in general, I think, as a species, as a intelligent being, as a whole, we have neglected our non-physical or spiritual development to the point where we're like an infant there, where at the same time we've made, you know, we can leap into at least near space, but
yeah.
At the same time, you know, our spiritual development has us, you know, crawling around in the mud.
Has gone backwards, if anything.
Yeah, and
I think you focused in on a key point, because if you look at our view of reality, there's been two opposing views in history. One, which we have raised to the pinnacle, is that everything's material. It's called material realism. And the only things that are real are things that have mass, that can be measured, that can be weighed, that can be touched.
Yeah, the Church of Science.
Yeah. The other viewpoint, which is what most of the Eastern philosophies have always gone by, is that everything is consciousness, and that the world of matter and the world of thought are all called up, if you like, from a dimension outside of the material that's this transcendental, immanent consciousness. Now, I think where modern physics is at the moment is we're starting to move from the older Newtonian model that was what material realism is built on, which really is a science of particles, because particles are things that can have position and mass and weight. And we're moving into an era or a paradigm where science is more going to begin to contemplate the nature of fields. Now, fields do not occupy one spot. They can't be measured. They can't be weighed. So I think even our science is reaching towards a synthesis that will eventually bring itself back into line with what reality really is. But at the moment, we've got to survive the debt of 400 years of material reductionism and our fascination of breaking things into smaller parts and making the whole world a machine. So we believe like we've had the right to run the world like it's a machine, not like a living thing, like it really is.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the next 400 years brings. It's too bad we're not going to get a chance to hang around and see the whole story, right?
It's going to be interesting to see what the next 30 years brings. We're living in exponential times. There's going to be more change in the next 30 years than there was in the last 400.
You know, I think about it. My great-grandparents went from horse and buggy and trains and...
space.
Yeah, into space.
I know. I think about that all the time.
And, you know, I remember my great-grandmother's fascination with convenience foods in the 60s. And some of them weren't all that good, okay?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we were all guinea pigs.
Yeah, I can remember this cereal. I don't remember if it was a hot or cold cereal, but, you know, it had these strawberries that were supposed to plump up like just like fresh ones. And they remained these hard brown lumps that floated in whatever liquid was added to them. I don't remember. I was a kid. And she was so disappointed. But I'm thinking, what did you expect it to do? It was a hard brown lump, you know? But yeah, she was just fascinated by convenience foods and canned hams and things like that, because it was
novelty
modern.
Has a powerful draw.
Yeah, I guess so. She would make the local grocer order all of these things that she saw on TV, and she was probably the only one that ever bought any of it.
Well, I think, you know, modern consumerism is based on the same thing. Nothing lasts more than a 2 months. Things come and go. It's constant novelty.
Yeah, everybody's going to have the latest product that's out on the television. I mean, look at our computers.
Going to mention Moore's Law, because the fact that the process has doubled in speed every 18 months since its inception, something like 29 times now, it's the most powerful technological advance that we've ever achieved. I mean, think about the invention of the automobile, like we were talking about. The first one probably did 5 mile an hour. And then, sure, a few years later, the next one did 10. and maybe the next one did 20, and maybe the next one even did 40.
30 miles an hour was going to be fatal to the human body. It could not sustain.
Well, my point is, it didn't take very long before we couldn't keep doubling the speed of it every time. You know, if that was true, our automobiles would now be going about 25,000 miles an hour.
Right.
But the computer processor is continuing to double every 18 months, exponentially. So the power of what we're creating is just mind-blowing. I don't think as humans, I don't think as a species, we're anywhere near keeping up with that technology.
I just wish they'd invent one that worked. The blue screen of death, the bane of everybody's existence.
Well, you know, we wouldn't have been having this conversation 15 years ago.
Oh, you know, I think about it. Okay, you know, I have an air card. I have a laptop. My laptop battery lasts like 5 or 6 hours. I can log into the internet any place I can get a cell phone signal. I could talk to people all over the world through that little box, which is smaller than the smallest typewriter I ever owned. I remember a typewriter that I had that was just amazing. It was no bigger than a three-ring notebook.
When I was a kid, I had the idea that one day all my music would be on a computer. And I had this grand idea of this big, huge computer with speakers all through the house and how it would play my music, you know. I didn't conceive the iPod would be the size of a cigarette pack.
Oh, I have an MP3 player at the fall, I lose it. You know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I honestly think I'm something of a futurist, and it's hard to even imagine the future these days.
Even the cell phone, okay? You know, I remember when I was a kid, if somebody had a car phone, they were important. That was all capital letters, by the way. And it was this huge box in their car.
Yeah.
It was called a car phone.
Yeah.
And it was very expensive to use, too. Now, you know, I'm talking to everybody tonight with a little cell phone that probably has more computing power than what got the Apollo astronauts to the moon.
Yeah, I know. The first supercomputers that, you know, occupied buildings and buildings of the Pentagon, now, you know, there's more power in it than a home calculator.
Yeah, well, I remember the Nintendo 64 had more computing power. This was an actual comparison that it had more computing power than the computers that sent those Apollo astronauts to the moon. And, you know, I used to think, if somebody came to me and said, look, I'm going to send you to the moon, we're going to use a Nintendo to do this, I'd tell them, you're out of your ever-loving mind.
Yeah.
I mean, who'd want to go to the moon with a Nintendo setting, an old Nintendo setting up?
Well, you know, it's this exponential growth of technology that has a lot of people hopeful that our society will survive the future. I tend to take a darker view based purely on the numbers available to me about our population, our resources, and just by looking at the general mentality of world leadership. But, you know, you have to wonder in the next 30 years if there isn't going to be some kind of amazing synthesis with the technology we're creating and you know, our own consciousness. But like I said, I really believe that we're not keeping up with what we're creating. Like, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope and the balloons, the telescopes they put up by balloon at the South Pole, they have changed our view of cosmology more than, you know, everything that's come before it. The things that are the images and the information and the data that is pouring in to those telescopes every day is totally revolutionary. But we're barely even able to scratch the surface of actually realizing what it all means. You know, we would be far better off putting a lot of the scientists in the world who are building weaponry on to trying to figure out what's the information that's pouring in from those telescopes.
Yeah, I keep wondering, how many ways do we need to have to blow ourselves up? I mean, come on.
We've got enough. We're pretty good at it. You know.
Yeah, we really don't need to figure out any more ways to blow ourselves up. Let's work on ways to, you know, make
I think it's very
better.
Interesting, getting back to entheogens, that LSD was invented within a few years of our society using nuclear weapons in warfare for the sole occasion that we have. Now, LSD is interesting because it's the only entheogen that a chemist can produce millions of hits of in an afternoon. And the effect it had on Western spirituality, I don't think can really any longer be denied. Much of our interest in Eastern spirituality, much of the lack of faith in the Christian church, much of what's come over the last 40 years came a lot from that generation's experimentation with LSD. It created the environmental movement, created this idea that the earth is a living organism, you know. And it's interesting the way these things coincide. That first photograph of Earth floating in space, those of us born after that year probably don't think much of it, but imagine how completely transcendental it was to actually see the Earth from outer space for the first time. Truly, it changed our view of the planet. We could see it as a delicate little bubble, you know. It's interesting the way all these things are coming together at the same time in history.
It'll be interesting to see what we do with it, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Tibetans believe we choose the area we're incarnated into. So I'm personally fascinated for the next few years, and I'm enjoying these ones thoroughly.
Yeah, you know, there's that. It's supposed to be a Chinese curse of may you live in interesting times. We certainly all live in interesting times. Whether we choose to regard it as a curse or a blessing is up to us, I think.
Well, Carl Jung wrote in 1936 an essay called The Problem of Spirituality in Humankind, that a enlightened intellect is like a burden of guilt, or a higher intellect is like a burden of guilt. And I certainly understand what he's coming from these days, because I think if you truly can pull your mind out of the mire that modern society creates for us, and you get a clear picture of what's really going on, you have a certain responsibility to the planet, to yourself, to the rest of humanity, to make positive moves towards influencing the future of our race. Too many people these days think it's out of their hands, and we all need to make better efforts, whether it's shopping locally or the things we were talking about earlier, or trying to understand their own spirituality, or we need to do what we can close to home to make change, because the more people that make change, the more change will come.
And make meaningful change, not just change things for the sake of something different.
Yeah, change.
No more meaningful than changing your wardrobe.
Meaningful change in the sense try and do things that are going to influence the course of our history. And we're all doing them every day. A lot of us just don't realize it.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realize a lot of things. When you watch them walking down the street, you can't help but think that many people are sleepwalking.
Yeah,
they're really not aware of anything beyond their credit rating and their next paycheck.
Yeah, there are twice as many people on Earth as there were 40 years ago, but I'm not sure there are twice as many enlightened people.
No, you know, it's like we have a limited pool of consciousness, perhaps, and now it's being divided up further.
That's one of the questions I like to ask the Tibetan masters is, according to the mechanism of reincarnation, if there's only so many souls, how can there be so many more people?
Maybe they're being born prematurely. They haven't time to get enlightened or whatever it is that they do when they're not incarnated.
Well, that's kind of what I think. There's a lot of fresh souls out there.
Yeah, they're just kind of lost.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get found these days.
Yeah. We are getting down to the wire, so once again, tell everybody the title of your book.
My book's called Tryptamine Talus, 5-MeO-DMT in the Sonoran Desert Toad, A Journey from Burning Man to the Akashic Field. We only touched on a handful of topics in my book today, but I appreciate the chance to talk to you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. People are interested. I've been interviewed by High Times magazine, and it's coming out in the January issue. I believe there's a 3-page excerpt from my book. I also believe I have a Wired magazine interview coming up. And I will be speaking at the Symbiosis Festival in California, near Yosemite, 9:30 Friday night, this Friday, after Alex Gray, and I'm hoping somebody turns up.
Yep, and for those of you who would like something to read about James, if you go to exogenynetwork.com, you can click on Dawn of Shades, and then on the left-hand side, there's going to be a page right there for James, just like the other guests. So, James, remember to send us updates so we can update your page now and again when you have new appearances coming up.
Thank you very much. My friends will call me Rock, by the way.
Oh, they call you Rock, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, James didn't happen to not fit you all that particularly well, so I can see where they would call you Rock.
I'm usually in trouble when someone calls me James.
It has that kind of mother sound to it. Well, folks, we have run out of time again. I want to thank James Ark for joining us tonight and being such a fantastic guest. I've enjoyed the program tonight, and I hope all of you have, too, as well as having found that it provided plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we bring you Jerry E. Smith, author of Weather Warfare, and another fascinating episode of The Dawn of Shades. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.